Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, December 30th. We're going to go to space the next hour of our program today and talk about whether or not we should be going to Mars. Do we need to go to the moon first? What is the incoming administration's plans concerning space exploration? What's this tiff between the NASA director and the Obama administration, if there is one, or if that's just been overblown? Where have we been? Where are we going? Can we afford to do much more with the space program, considering what's happening economically in this country? So many questions this hour of the program, and we have two superb guests with us. Professor Scott Hubbard is joining us. Professor Hubbard is Stanford University Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics and the Carl Sagan Chair for the Study of Life in the Universe at the SETI Institute. Professor Hubbard has made significant contributions to research, development, and management of space missions for over 25 years and has served as Deputy Director for Research at NASA's Ames Research Center in the heart of California's Silicon Valley. He is joining us, and also Professor Lewis Friedman is with us. He helped co-found the Planetary Society and brought to his position as Executive Director a wealth of experience in the space exploration community, including 10 years at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and 5 years at the Avco Space Systems Division. He's been a guiding force with the Society for over 20 years and is still quite excited, as both our guests are, about humanity's journey into the solar system. We'll be welcoming phone calls for both our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. Professor Hubbard, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
I'm glad to be there.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation. And Professor Lewis Friedman, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have both of you with us. So tell me, why Mars? Why should we go to Mars?
Well, I'll start off.
All right.
Mars is the most Earth-like object in the solar system. If you look anywhere in the solar system and try to find a place where life might have emerged, or could even still be there, Mars is the most logical target. You can get to it every 2 years. And I think one of the great questions that fascinates me, and I believe a lot of human beings, is, are we alone in the universe?
Oh, yeah.
And if you're going to find that out, I think that Mars is the place to go. That's why we've sent a number of missions there over the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I can add to that.
Okay.
In addition to past life and present life, it's the only planet we can reach where we can imagine establishing life in the future. And for the future of humanity, I think that's a huge question about whether or not we are hidebound on Earth or going to move around the space. And this and at Mars, this is all going to be determined, not quickly, but it's certainly the goal as we move out. Mars is the only place we can imagine doing this.
Mm-hmm. Professor Hubbard, how much money would it take, and what kind of plan do we need to get there?
Well, getting there with robots is something we've been doing for quite a while now. I had the great opportunity to be what they called the Mars Czar. I was the first Mars program director and restructured the program in the year 2000. And
oh.
So Mars Odyssey, the twin rovers, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, the Phoenix mission, all those things were part of that architecture from 8 or 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And those missions have been costing the U.S. about $500 or $600 million a year, averaged out, which, considering that the total cost of the government, I think is a bargain, and it's told us a great deal. If you want to now go and have human beings set foot on Mars, the price tag goes up considerably, but then the return on investment is probably a lot higher as well. So it's hard to give a specific number, but human exploration is, I would say, 10 to 100 times more expensive than robotic exploration.
Right. When were the twin rovers there?
Well, the twin rovers are still there. They were launched in the year they arrived in 2003.
Did they?
And so they are entering their fifth year of operations.
I remember when they were there. It doesn't seem like it was 5 years ago already, does it?
They're still operating,
yeah.
And then they're just entering their fifth year of operations.
What are we getting from them now?
Well, they're continuing to look at all of this terrain, these different layers. They've found evidence of a salty, wet Mars past. They've even found pure silica. They've found these little minerals that are evidence of a lot of past water on Mars, and they're giving us an extraordinary picture of places we've never been to, and it's just a fascinating view of a whole new world on Mars.
Oh, you must so much want to be there, don't you?
Oh, yes. I would love. In fact, a good friend of mine, Chris McKay, who is a field astrobiologist, I mean, he studies what extremes of life are out in the field, has said if you just put him on Mars, he could tell you in one day what it's taken 5 years for the rovers to do.
Huh. Professor Friedman, I'm a little confused about this. Do we need to go to the moon before we go to Mars?
Well, NASA says that it's been many years since they've had human exploration beyond Earth orbit. They've been confined to low Earth orbit with the shuttle flights for more than 3 decades now. And the idea of being able to go way out to Mars with a risky several-year mission is, they say, too big a step. Now, others who are not in NASA sometimes think that we do know the technology for that just as we did, or we do know how to do that just as much as we were ready to go to the moon back in the 1960s. But we have to grant that NASA is going to be the agency that's going to do it, and probably doing a few sorties on the moon with limited objectives of practicing the landing, practicing the surface operations before you go to Mars is a good idea, and you can develop the systems on the way to do that. What we're concerned about at the Planetary Society is the moon doesn't become a detour, but that it should just be a way station or a stepping stone on the way to Mars.
And what do you mean by detour?
Well, there are some people who would advocate, no, just go to the moon, set up a lunar base, build a long-term permanent infrastructure there. They don't have a good idea what that infrastructure would really accomplish, but they do have an objective of wanting to make a long-term lunar program. If we do that, we could get bogged down and sort of give up exploration at the behest of building large engineering systems. What we're about, what we really want to promote, is the idea that we keep exploring outwards. We have so much new knowledge, new discovery, mm-hmm. new accomplishments to make by moving both robots and people out into the solar system.
Mm-hmm. What is it that's kept us from getting to Mars with human beings by now? We went to the moon what seems like a long time ago now, Professor Hubbard. Why have we not made more progress in that area?
Well, there's a number of reasons. The principal obstacles are, first of all, technological. With the Saturn V having been discontinued many years ago at the end of the Apollo era, we no longer have a launch vehicle that's capable of getting us beyond low Earth orbit. So you need to have that vehicle. You need to understand the biomedical problems. Going to the moon is a 3-day journey. But going to Mars is a 7-month journey to get there. You'd want to spend at least 6 months on the surface, and it's 7 or 8 or 9 months to get back, depending on when you return. Being exposed to the radiation and microgravity for that long a time is something that produces biomedical effects that we don't really fully understand, and you wouldn't want to send astronauts on a one-way trip or with dangers that are poorly understood. And then there is just the cost, building vehicles capable of doing all this, providing the life support. You have to be able to take enough water and oxygen or make it when you get there so as to sustain what could be up to a 3-year round trip. So you put all those things together, and it is a significant financial and technological and biomedical hurdle.
Mm-hmm. And I know you can't tell this unless we got people there, but how would this add to our knowledge? What would we be looking for there to see if we're alone in the universe? You don't expect us to find people, do you?
No. In fact, I've often said that I would die a happy scientist if I either found microbes on Mars or pond scum on Europa. Most people that study the emergence of life in the universe say that if we find another life form on Mars, it is very likely to be of some microbe, of a bacteria, of some type of an algae or something. But if you did find evidence of a second genesis, that would tell us an enormous amount about whether or not life is rare or very common in the universe. So if you put the right scientist down there, the human being has been evolving in its current form for maybe 2 million years. And the eye-brain combination and the ability to adapt to completely unusual environments of a human being is just extraordinary. So you put the right person there, and they can look around, and in less than a minute probably identify the right spot or the right rock or the right place to drill. And it takes our robots, which are very sophisticated, hours and even days to do the same kind of thing. So we could learn a lot more, much more quickly. It's expensive to get them there.
Yeah. I would like to find people, wouldn't you, Professor Friedman?
We all grew up with the notion of Mars having aliens down there. But, Mars has never disappointed us. We didn't find aliens there, or at least people there. We may yet find alien microbes there. But Mars has never disappointed us as a fascinating place. And to add to what Scott just mentioned, it is going to teach us much about habitability. Mars is a planet that has almost entirely carbon dioxide atmosphere, but a lot of water underground. Are there habitable regions on Mars? How does that relate to the interaction of carbon dioxide and water and in our own atmosphere? How is the evolution of Mars from a warmer and wetter planet to a now colder and drier planet? How is that affected any possible habitable zones on Mars? These are things that teach us about not just Mars itself, but the habitability of terrestrial planets, of Earth planets, Earth-like planets, I should say. And these are really important questions, not just relating to those of us in the space business, but relating to all those who are trying to understand our own planet and its evolution and processes of global change.
Mm-hmm.
So your question about what we're going to learn there is, you answered it yourself. We don't know exactly, but we do know we're going to get valuable information to understand the processes that affect our lives in the past and in the future.
I know that you had a meeting at the beginning of this year that is ending right now with a group of scientists and former astronauts saying that the next president of the United States should give NASA an additional $3 billion to get to Mars and also to focus attention on science issues in space and also on Earth. Would you adjust that figure now, and do you have any hopes that the new administration will take you up on that idea?
Well, it's not just the money is important because they have been making compromises in NASA for the last 5 years with trying to balance this need of sending of restoring the human program to an exploration program and still conduct the basic sciences of robotic missions to the planets and Earth and space science missions have not been had to suffer in the last several years. And so the money recommendation was not so much just about exploration itself, but was about exploration and science working together. One of the key results of our workshop, which we held at Stanford University, the Planetary Society and Stanford combined on this, was that the human space exploration program has enormous international and geopolitical significance. It was that way during Apollo. It was that way during the space station when we engaged the Russians. What's up there at the space station now has tremendous international cooperation involving Europeans, Russians, Japanese, and Canadians, and other countries. And going to Mars in the future will be a important international event. I think the Obama administration, they actually said that in their space policy statement. So I'm quite hopeful that they will be introducing some international initiatives that will result in the space program and in space exploration being used for national and international purposes in a much more meaningful way.
Do you think that will happen, Professor Hubbard?
I think it could. Everything that we see thus far about the Obama administration is that they are going to be much more open to international collaboration. They're willing to have a dialogue with the rest of the world that was not the hallmark of the previous administration. So I think it is a potential. I think it is an extraordinarily good potential. And I think the other thing that we might want to touch on is if you look at the appointments thus far, the science appointments, the people like Steve Chu,
yes.
John Holdren, his science team is very heavily weighted toward the atmosphere, the environment, climate change, energy, and that whole different area of research. So NASA, as you probably know, has the charter to provide the remote sensing, the satellites that monitor Earth's climate and climate change and so forth, and I could see the agency playing a very significant role in the Obama administration in that area.
Let's welcome phone calls for our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're looking at the future of space exploration in the United States as we welcome a new administration pretty soon now, just a few weeks. Our guests, Professor Lewis Friedman, Executive Director of the Planetary Society, a group that promotes space exploration and was co-founded by Carl Sagan and Lewis Friedman, actually. Professor Scott Hubbard is also with us, Stanford University Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics and the Carl Sagan Chair for the Study of Life in the Universe. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and we will start with Mike from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask your guest, is there anything we can learn from manned space missions that we can't eventually learn from unmanned or robotic missions?
Hmm.
Well, that's a question that often comes up. In fact, when we held the workshop back in February, we had a panel devoted to that, that is to say, comparing the capabilities of robotic exploration now and in the future and what humans can do. And I think that while you might make the argument that if you spent the equivalent budget, you might push robotics along very significantly, there are a few things that make human exploration, I believe, inevitable. One is the national engagement, the national interest in having humans in space. I can't imagine any president stepping up and saying, we're going to abandon human exploration and leave it to fill in the blank, China, India, Russia, or whatever. The second thing is just the human condition. I think human beings are explorers. We want to go out there. We want to report back what we've learned. We want to have people now with virtual environments go along with us. And then the scientific piece that the caller brought up is a very important one. Let me give you very briefly an experiment that Steve Squires did. He's the principal investigator for the two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. And he did a ground-based experiment with his scientists and found that they could identify in less than a minute a scientifically interesting rock where the rovers, with the current technology, took almost an entire day to do that. So human beings at this point are still better, more adaptable, and more capable in identifying where the science is than our current generation of robots. So I think there's definitely a future for humans in space.
And thank you very much for the call. Tell me, both of you, what kind of tests need to be done or are being done to see how the human body responds to that amount of time in space that far away? Would it be hard for us to make that mission?
Well, you know, on the space station, there have been Russian cosmonauts have been there more than a year. And I've met them now since they've come back to Earth, and they're in good health. We do know that there's changes in the body for long periods of time exposed to weightlessness. The bones begin to decalcify, and there could be bone damage if countermeasures are not taken. But we are learning about those countermeasures with the space station and with other experiments in space. What we haven't learned yet is about the adaptation to radiation, both in protecting ourselves from it outside of the Earth's magnetic field, and also in coping with it if we have to for long periods of time. That's one of the great unknowns. I think Scott talked about that before, but we can learn that and the type of steps once we begin. Leaving Earth orbit, we could do longer and longer duration flights with humans, first beyond the moon, maybe then out to one of these gravitationally stable points near the Earth still, but at least at the edge of Earth's gravity field, and then move out, maybe even visit a near-Earth object, these important objects which are now known to come very close to Earth's orbit and occasionally impact the Earth. We could send an astronaut there on a several-month mission, all the time building up capability as to how to support his or her life, and also how do they adapt to the rigors of the long-duration spaceflight with both radiation and weightlessness. And then eventually, of course, we'll be sending him on the many-month mission to Mars and probably a 2-year round-trip mission or a 3-year round-trip mission. So there are challenges in the life sciences as well as in the engineering to support these missions, but they're ones we can learn about in a step-by-step approach as we move outward.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Andrew from Highland Park, Illinois. Hi, Andrew.
Good morning. It's a fascinating discussion. Thank you very much for it.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that one of NASA's most enduring legacies as a sponsor of pure research, all of the wonderful technological advances they've brought. I'm wondering if we ever see them returning to that as, just a sponsor of research as opposed to, maybe knowing exactly where the research would end up.
Well, that's one of the tensions that's been building within the agency as budgets have been shifted. When the so-called vision for space exploration was presented, to create a new replacement for the shuttle and then a new heavy lift vehicle that would be something like the old Saturn V. To do that, they moved money from the pure research realm. They took virtually all the life science money, the technology money, and so forth to start these new programs. And so the science community has been actually quite upset about this. They're feeling very pinched. And I think that in terms of an R&D stimulus, which is something the nation could use right now, I think NASA has an important role to play. We are pretty much building these new vehicles, which are called Ares 1 and Ares 5, using current technology. And NASA has had a history of pushing the envelope. So perhaps in the new administration, if there is funding available, or if there is some change in priorities made, there might be a reinvestment in advanced technology.
I thank you very much for the answer. Have a good day, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thanks, Andrew, very much for your call. Tom is next. Hi, Tom.
Yes, Kathleen, you kind of answered part of my question, but I was just curious if the new design to replace the Saturn V has already started, or if this has been kind of an ongoing project, and if so, what really are the major challenges of the new rocket that would replace the Saturn V? The engines, or actually what system would be the biggest challenge for the engineers?
Well, they're starting with the Ares 1, which would be a replacement for the shuttle. This is to get U.S. astronauts and presumably others, but particularly provide the U.S. with access to low Earth orbit, to the space station, and to start getting beyond low Earth orbit. The Ares 5, which would be a much larger vehicle and in some sense a follow-on or replacement for the Saturn V, is much less developed. The Ares 1 and the Ares 5 architecture are derived from the current shuttle components, but they are, in my view and in the view of many others, completely new vehicles. So the Ares 1, which is a long, slender vehicle using the solid rocket boosters in a 5-stage configuration that are very similar to what's used to boost the shuttle into orbit, have that development has encountered a lot of technological engineering problems, and you know, most likely with enough time and enough money, they can be solved. I have to say, though, that there are people in the community who have asked the question, why not take the two vehicles that were developed at the cost of billions of dollars, the Atlas V or the Delta IV, these are two so-called heavy lift vehicles, and use those to get humans to low Earth orbit. But the current path that NASA's on is to develop this new vehicle, and then they've just begun the design work for the Saturn V follow-on.
Well, thank you very much.
There's been a number of false starts over the past decades on building a new rocket. And right now there is momentum behind this Ares program. The Ares 1, as Scott indicated, is the short-term solution, which others said maybe there's different short-term solutions, but the Ares 5 and the building of the capability to go beyond Earth orbit to send humans out into interplanetary space, this was a long time overdue, and hopefully that commitment, which was made several years ago, will continue, because otherwise we'll continue to be trapped in the program of the past instead of one for the future.
Mm-hmm. Can you, I don't know if this is important or not, but certainly the press made a great deal of what the Washington Post called this kerfuffle about the discussion between the NASA Administrator Michael Griffin and the leader of President-elect Obama's transition team for the agency. Is there anything to this? Is this worrisome to both of you?
Well, I happened to be standing next to them.
Oh, you're kidding. Okay.
Well, they had their kerfuffle, supposed kerfuffle. And I can tell you that some of the blogger reports from which the Washington Post took their information were a little overdone. No one was angry. Nobody was yelling at each other. In fact, I was less than 3 feet away, and I couldn't hear the, and I couldn't overhear the conversation, no matter how much I tried. but I spoke to both the administrator Griffin and to Ms. Garver afterwards. I'm friends with both of them, and yeah, there's always tension. There's always been tension between the administrator who is charting a path and people who come in and want to review that path, especially in light of a different administration than the one that appointed him. This has gone on in every transition team and every agency for all of history. But I do think that too much was made of that kind of tension, which is over sort of specific facts and details. The good wishes of the people cooperating with each other to try and make the common program. I do know the people on the transition team. They are devoted to a vital space program. They're not. Their intent is the same as the administrator's, and the administrator thinks he's right about all the technical solutions, and other people have other ideas, and so of course there are tensions. But I don't think there's. I think too much was made of that particular conversation.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Tom from Windsor. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good morning, folks. I heard somewhere, I'm not sure where I heard it, and I'm wondering if it is possible that in theory, man can create an atmosphere on Mars that would support human life. And I'm not talking building domes or anything. I'm talking about creating an atmosphere around the whole planet that would support human life. And I'm just wondering about that, and I'll just listen to the answer on the radio. Thank you, folks.
Well, you're talking about engineering a planet.
Yeah, you're talking about terraforming, and numerous people, a scientist named Chris McKay among them, others have written about this. In fact, there's a science fiction series, Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars, that deals with this. In principle, if you introduce the right microbes, if you get the chemistry or the biochemistry right, you might be able to generate an atmosphere. The trick would be, I think, holding on to it. Mars lost its atmosphere over several billion years because of a combination of things. The gravity, which is only about a third the gravity of Earth, the fact that the planet cooled off, and its volcanic eruptions ceased, so you didn't have replacement atmosphere. So it's one of these fascinating ideas, kind of like the space elevator or something, that in principle might work, but I think the practicalities of it are very, very far in the future. I don't know, Lou, if you want to have another take on that one.
In that wonderful trilogy that Scott just mentioned, but even in science fiction, these are hundreds and hundreds of years into the future. And while us engineers might think we could theoretically do this, I think that any practical sense would have to say that it's many centuries into the future before that becomes even practical, even if you wanted to do it. And then, of course, there could be some arguments whether you really wanted to do it.
I always love to hear, because you gentlemen both are at the tops of your fields, and some of this still seems like science fiction to me, but I'm wondering, was it a clear sky when you were 3 years old or 5 years old that brought you into this other realm of wondering what's out there that got you on this path? Or how did you? I'm kind of jealous of what you do.
Well, not
actually,
for me. I was. I tell people I was raised in New York and live in Los Angeles, so I actually have never seen the night sky. It's not quite true, by the way. I'm a graduate of the University of Wisconsin, and so.
You are all right.
I'm talking to my home, my second home now.
Great.
In reality, it's not just the looking up into the night sky, which has been inspiring, but it's. At least for me, I'm a product of the first years of the space age. I was a freshman at the University of Wisconsin when Sputnik was launched. Mm. And I remember Professor Sumi coming in. He was introduced as America's first space scientist. And in my freshman year, I immediately signed up, inspired by the idea that this is the new field, this is where new great accomplishments are going to be made. And I immediately signed up in his course and other space engineering courses. So I think it's one of the unsung roles of the value of the space program has been to inspire students, inspire young people everywhere, even those that don't end up working in the field. Got turned on to science and engineering and math and great accomplishments in whatever field they go into by being able to work at the frontier. And I certainly did when I was, moved by the beginnings of the space age.
Great
story. Yeah, let me add just a little bit to that. Lou is a few years more senior than I. I was about 9 years old when Sputnik went up, but I remember it very, very vividly, and of course it was tied in with the Cold War. I mean, this was a demonstration of the technological power of the evil Soviet Empire, and people were not only fascinated by it, but they were frightened by it. But what it inspired me to do, I grew up in a little tiny town in Kentucky, so my history is kind of like that book Rocket Boys, you know, that turned into October Sky, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I launched rockets in the backyard and terrified the neighbors and, you know, mixed rocket fuel in the basement.
Oh, my gosh.
Until an explosion burned off my eyebrows and I was banished to the backyard. But one thing that came out of this, and it's a hope I have for the Obama administration, was the creation then of the National Defense Education Act. And I would never have been able to go to an expensive, top-quality school, Vanderbilt University, had that not provided for scholarships. And I really hope that the administration will realize the value of investing in the education of people in science and technology and engineering and so forth.
Yeah, I had that same National Defense Education Act aid when I was a student at the University of Wisconsin there, too. And, it did mean a great deal, and I think some of that is going to be getting attention in the new administration as to the way to stimulate people so they can afford to go to great colleges and be participants in these new ventures.
Yeah. Let's pause for just a moment and return and take more of your phone calls. We're talking about what next for space exploration this hour of the program. We have two marvelous guests with us, Professor Scott Hubbard at the Stanford University Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics. He is co-founder of the Carl Sagan. He is the Carl Sagan Chair for the Study of Life in the Universe at the SETI Institute. And Professor Lewis Friedman is Executive Director and co-founder with Carl Sagan of the Planetary Society. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. Returning to your calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go back to your phone calls now. Jamie is next from Colfax. Hi, Jamie.
Hello. Morning, Kathleen and your guests. I'm kind of curious about the technology, like the equipment and stuff that was left on the moon and how much is on Mars and if that's reusable when we send manned missions again. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks, Jamie.
But there is a significant amount of hardware that was left behind by the Apollo missions that landed. And, of course, we have the two rovers on Mars at the moment. There's still the two Viking landers sitting there from the mid-1970s. I think the main value of what was left behind is going to be as an icon, as a more than a museum piece, really. And in fact, we haven't talked about the so-called Google Lunar X Prize, but this is a $30 million prize put up by the founders of Google, who give you extra credit if you're a competitor in this, and you can actually go and take a picture of some of the Apollo hardware. I think there's an extra $5 million that you can win in this prize. So I think seeing where we have been, the footprints of the past before, is something that will be important for humanity to reflect on. But its actual engineering capability or usefulness, I think, is minimal.
Yeah, I think we're not going to be able to reuse it. But on this Phoenix lander that just went to Mars in the North Polar region, the Planetary Society placed a DVD on board, which is the first volume in a Martian library. It's a book of the science fiction that has inspired Mars exploration from around the world. And our hope, which is well documented, in fact, is even documented with an inscription on the thing, on the DVD, is that future explorers on Mars will someday come up to this, pick up the DVD. Hopefully there'll be somebody around who remembers what a DVD was, that old-fashioned Earth technology, and be able to learn what inspired this generation of explorers to go to Mars. So we do send, in fact, for those of your listeners who want to go to our website, planetary.org, and look for messages from Earth, we do try to send things that are meaningful on these spacecraft that somehow convey something about ourselves for future explorers.
Mm-hmm. That is interesting. They probably won't know what a DVD is within 10 years, don't you think? Who knows what we'll be using?
Technology is certainly evolving fast, and I'd be stuck right now if somebody gave me a 78 record, a 78 RPM record to play and
right.
Try to learn.
Right.
You didn't save your Victrola?
I did. I saved too much, though. Let's go to Mark from Madison. Hi, Mark.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
excuse me. My question is about propulsion. It's my impression that we're tied to rockets, which are expensive and heavy to get off the ground. And I was wondering what other means of propulsion is on the horizon.
Well, there are numerous attempts that have been made over the years to get beyond the current, which is to say the last 40 years of chemical propulsion. And generally what the engineers and technologists have run into have been difficulties in scaling up something that works in the laboratory to something that is large enough to either put a robot into orbit or send human beings somewhere. Now, there are a few things that have been demonstrated recently that could well be of value in the future. One is so-called solar electric propulsion. There have been several missions, one U.S., one European mission, that use the power of the sun together with a certain type of gas, in this case a very unusual or rare gas called xenon, but it creates a very low thrust, but for long periods of time. So you can continue to accelerate and accelerate, and over time, you can get going, to a pretty good clip. This has been done with robotic satellites. In principle, it might be useful for future human exploration. There is something called hybrid propulsion. This is much safer than the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen that is used. It is basically, in its most primitive form, laughing gas and ground up old rubber tires or paraffin wax. But that type of propulsion, that type of chemical mixture, was what was used to win the Ansari X Prize, the first private venture twice to the edge of space. Used this kind of hybrid propulsion, and there are those who believe you can scale that up now. In fact, Virgin Galactic is going to be offering somewhere in the next, I'd say 5 years, rides to the edge of space using this much safer form of propulsion. So that plus other more exotic things, nuclear propulsion and so forth, are things that need to be developed in the future. Mm-hmm.
Scott, I'm surprised you forgot solar sailing, which is a
I left that for you, Lou, and the Planetary Society. Go ahead.
We're trying to launch the first solar sail, and solar sailing is better than all of those forms of propulsion because it doesn't use any propellant. It just uses sunlight to propel the spacecraft, just like the wind propels a sailboat in the ocean. None of these things will get you off the Earth. You're going to need rockets to get off the Earth. Afraid that we're going to have to. It's one of the disadvantages of living in a gravity well. But I know we do hope to launch a solar sail flight in the next year or two as a means of building the technology that will someday take us to the stars. Because if we're ever going to do interstellar propulsion, we're going to need something exotic like that that doesn't require propellant on board to be carried over those long distances.
Thank you, Mark, so much for your call. Ron is next from Edgerton. Hi, Ron.
Hello.
Hello, Ron.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a financial question. First of all, I'd like to express my respect for the people in the space endeavor. But I was just curious about... I have a question, and that is, why a toolkit that gets lost in space is equal to the equity that I have in my home? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Why?
Well, let's see. Who wants to field that one?
Well, NASA has actually put out a press statement trying to explain this this very expensive toolkit that was taken to space. Everything that gets space qualified, everything that gets has to be used, does cost more than if you had to go to the hardware store and get it and then have it come out. When something comes apart on me that I buy at the hardware store, I can run over there in about 15 minutes and replace it. That's not true when you take it to space. So a lot more reliability is required in those things. And of course, but the main point I think was that some of the cost estimation of what that really cost was overblown as well in the press and in the media. But things do cost more in space, and that's both one of the disadvantages, and that's why some of these missions are a strain to be used. But it's also one of the advantages, because we are taking these technologies and we're pushing the envelope of things that will ultimately be made cheap. We would have never developed cheap computers if we didn't pay for expensive computers in space to work out all the bugs and do the programming and learn how to miniaturize them and do so many things that were evolved in space technology with computers that ultimately led to us being able to buy computers for our home for a few hundred dollars. But when we were first using these computing powers in the Apollo program and then the early robotic programs, they were many millions of dollars for this kind of computing capability. So things do cost more, but it's part of the use of technology in very exotic and extreme environments under very difficult conditions.
Yeah, it's one of a kind, and the promise of the commercial space ventures that people like Richard Branson and Virgin Galactic are working on is that if it becomes more routine, the cost per trip will come way down. I mean, Those of us who are past a certain age remember Alan Shepard and the first suborbital flight that the U.S. made. The investment in that was certainly many, many millions of dollars. The projected price for the same ride to the edge of space Virgin Galactic or one of their competitors is in the $100,000 to $200,000 category. So when you do something once, it's very special, and you need to make sure it's completely reliable. It costs a great deal. Over time, as has happened with aviation, as you repeat the thing, it can become much more cost-effective.
Let's go to Mike now from Oshkosh. Hi, Mike. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Yeah, just a quick funding question. I know within the Defense Department, they have similar competing interests that want to fund different projects. And the way that they do it is every 4 years, they do a thing called the Quadrennial Defense Review. They actually look at the missions that would potentially fund new weapon systems and such. And that's how they fund those projects. I'm wondering within NASA if they do a similar thing. Do they have these reviews, the strategic vision assessments, and then they fund reporting?
Yeah, well, I spent 20 years within NASA and ended up, before I retired, as the director of NASA Ames. And so I lived through many zero-based reviews, many strategic planning reviews, and so forth. The thing that's a little bit different from the DOD, which, by the way, has a space budget twice the size of NASA's, is that missions that NASA undertakes, like a mission to Jupiter or Saturn, may take a decade in the planning, it may take a decade in the execution, and you might have data coming back for another 5 to 8 years. So when you're talking about missions that consume a total of maybe 20 or even 30 years from conception to final data, it's very difficult to replan that or change it on a year-to-year basis. You really need a long-term vision. And for that, the agency, NASA, has started relying more and more on what the National Academy of Sciences, the National Academy of Engineering will produce. For 40 years, the astronomy community has been using a so-called decadal survey. That's where the astronomers under the direction of the National Academy of Sciences, which is independent, not tied to any government political issue, will say this is the queue of missions that makes the most scientific sense. The planetary exploration people have started doing this, and some of the other science groups as well. So at least one part of NASA has been using for some time now the input of a major body, a major group like the National Academy, to give some guidance.
Hmm. Let's go next to Jeff from Pewaukee, probably our last call. We're coming to the end of the hour. Hi, Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Are you there? Well, let's try. Oh, our phones don't seem to be working. We're in a new building, gentlemen, so we're just trying this out. There we go. Jeff, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, I have more of a comment than a question. I was around in the 60s, and I remember one of the primary reasons given for sending men to the moon was that the Russians might do it. We have to beat the Russians. Now we're being told exactly the same thing for spending all this money to go to the moon again because the Chinese might do it. And I really strongly disagree with Bush's change to the space program, and we should go back to science and not be wasting a lot of money to try to send people to the moon and Mars.
Well, I think you make a very good point, and this situation now is not the same as it was with the perceived Soviet threat of going to the moon and the challenge by President Kennedy to beat them there. But and I think now the primary impetus is probably more cooperation than working together with other space-faring nations to make great accomplishments in space. One of the reasons the Planetary Society actually de-emphasized going back to the moon as a goal in its recent recommendations was for the same reasoning you just mentioned. But having said that, it's probably impossible to think that a president of the United States would come in and say, well, let's give up human space exploration now. Other nations can do it. That's kind of like what Portugal and the Netherlands decided back in the 16th and 17th centuries. They were exploring seafaring nations, and they gave it up and abandoned it to other countries. I don't think that would be a politically acceptable or realistic goal for the United States to make. So the challenge is not to tell them to give it up, but to tell them to use it intelligently for national purposes, for international cooperation. And I think that's more behind our recommendations than it is to say that we have to beat the Chinese in something that we've already done 40 years ago.
Thanks very much for your call. Gentlemen, it was a marvelous hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, so
it was my pleasure
also. Thank you. Thank you. Our thanks to Professor Lewis Friedman, Executive Director of the Planetary Society, co-founder with Carl Sagan of that organization, Professor Scott Hubbard, Stanford University Department of Aeronautics, and the Carl Sagan Chair for the Study of Life in the Universe at the SETI Institute. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production. Thanks for listening and calling, everybody. Until tomorrow on the Ideas Network.